Act to work order. The truckers are threatened with fines and even jail sentences for those refusing to get back behind the wheel. Frank Smith, WeWang, South Korea.
Yemen is on the road to achieving self-sufficiency, with government plans and strategies aimed at doubling and expanding Yemeni agriculture and local food production. On this trip to a Yemeni farmland, I am accompanied by Wajih Al-Mutawakkil. The man is in charge of vegetable production in Yemen. Al-Mutawakkil is one of the government officials leading the campaign to revive Yemen's rich agriculture. He is here to show us the agricultural projects the government is funding.
We are now on the outskirts of Sana'a, right behind Sana'a International Airport, and beyond this point is where Yemen's agricultural renaissance is beginning to take place. Here, there's farmers that are planting crops such as garlic, onions, barley, and wheat. And these are crops that are vital to keeping the Yemeni economy afloat and keeping Yemenis from going hungry during this strangling economic blockade imposed by Saudi Arabia.
One of the ways to counter food shortage in Yemen is through the launch of water-based greenhouse projects.
These are the greenhouse projects we launched. There are about 8 on this farm. These are water-based greenhouse, which means we plant crops using gravel instead of soil. This gravel is extracted from the Yemeni mountains. This greenhouse project is made up of organic natural materials found only in Yemen.
Outside of these gas houses is an even more vital crop being harvested in acres of land that stretch beyond the horizon. Yemeni wheat. According to the Ministry of Agriculture, Yemen imports an estimated 4 million tons of wheat a year from foreign countries. To achieve self-sufficiency status, Yemen must produce its own wheat in order to eliminate its dependency on foreign imports. Farmers on the outskirts of the Yemeni capital are answering the call to produce more wheat.
This portion of the wheat is ready to be reaped, while the rest of the field is going to take another week to a week and a half before it is ready.
I like to take the wheat and grind it with my hands. Then I blow away the flax, and now it's ready for consumption.
As food production increases, many organizations have been formed to help achieve food security. Guan Foundation for Development in Agriculture is one of them. Guan Foundation educates Yemenis on the importance of helping the advance of the nation through agricultural initiatives. Guan also specializes in the production of basic foods from a combination of Yemeni seeds and grains at their local factory. They have even started their own brand of flour and healthy snacks sold in and out of the country. Guan's president believes that Yemen's high-quality agriculture must be revived in order to provide healthy food options for Yemenis and to eradicate some of the diseases caused by imported foods.
International organizations are playing and have played a large role in destroying Yemeni agriculture. They did so by exporting grain and wheat to us, which is often rotten and contains harmful substances like chemicals. Additionally, these grain shipments that enter Yemen have passed their expiration date, which results in a lot of illnesses.
After the revolution of September 21st in 2014, achieving self-sufficiency in Yemen is no longer an impossible task. According to Yemen's Ministry of Agriculture, if local food production continues to increase, Yemen could reach food security in just a few years. The revolution against Western hegemony in Yemen was a starting point towards achieving self-sufficiency, which according to the Ansarullah leader is essential in order to secure food provisions for Yemenis. Yusuf Maudi, the outskirts of the Yemeni capital.
A
Chile has fallen on relations between Moscow and the Vatican City. The rift has been sparked by an interview published in a U.S. magazine on Monday in which the head of the Catholic Church, Pope Francis, condemned, quote, the cruelty of some minority groups of soldiers, namely the Chechens and the Siberian Buryats, in the Ukraine's conflict. On Tuesday, Moscow's ambassador to the Vatican, Alexander Avdiiv, lodged an official complaint in response. Pope Francis' remarks were made during an interview with America, a Jesuit magazine headquartered in New York. When asked about his apparent reluctance to directly condemn Russia for the war in Ukraine, the pontiff said in response that he received much information about the cruelty of the troops. The Russian ambassador to the Holy See, Avdiiv, expressed anger at the pontiff's, quote, insinuation of alleged atrocities by the Russian military during the course of the special military operation in Ukraine. The ambassador also stressed that nothing can shake the cohesion and unity of the multinational Russian people. The Russian Foreign Ministry also dismissed Pope Francis' comments.
What will the Vatican tell us about the martyrdom of the multinational Soviet people? Maybe it makes sense to first discuss Catholic penance for the 20th century for the Orthodox and for Muslims for the many centuries before that. This is no longer Russophobia. It's a perversion of the truth on a level I can't even name.
Earlier this week, Moscow had welcomed the Vatican's announcement of mediation to bring an end to the Russian-Ukrainian war. Some fear that this could no longer be viable after this diplomatic incident.
I don't think this tense moment will change the Vatican-Russia relations substantially. Moscow still expects the Holy See to position itself as a mediator in the conflict with Ukraine. But whether the mediation takes off will very much depend on Kiev and largely on the U.S.
On Sunday, top Vatican diplomat Archbishop Paul Richard Gallagher had said the Holy See and Pope Francis are ready to provide space for peace negotiations on Ukraine. However, after the announcement, Moscow said Kiev is against any peace talks. Max Civili, Rome.
This is IRIB English Radio. Website is www.parstoday.com/en.
The supplication on Tuesdays. In the name of Allah, the All-Merciful, the All-Compassionate. Praise belongs to Allah, and praise is His right, since Him deserves it, abundant praise. I seek refuge in Him from the evil of my soul, for surely the soul commands to evil, except as my Lord has mercy. I seek refuge in Him from the evil of Satan, who adds sins to my sin. I seek protection with Him from every wicked tyrant and unjust sovereign and conquering enemy. O Allah, place me among Thy troops are the victors, and place me in Thy party, for Thy party are the ones who prosper. And place me among Thy friends, for Thy friends no fear shall be upon them, nor shall they sorrow. O Allah, set right for me my religion, for it is the preserving tie of my affair. Set right for me my hereafter, for it is the abode of my permanent lodging, and to it I flee from the neighborhood of the vile. Make life an increase for me in every good, and death an ease for me from every evil. O Allah, bless Muhammad, the seal of the prophets, and the completion of the number of the envoys, and his household, the good, the pure, and his household, the good, the pure, and his companions, the distinguished. And give me on the Tuesday three things. Leave no sin for me unless Thou forgives it. And leave no grief unless Thou takes it away. And leave no enemy. And leave no enemy unless Thou repelst him. By means of in the name of Allah, the best of the names. In the name of Allah, Lord of earth and heaven, I seek to repulse every hateful thing, the first of which is His anger. And I seek to attract every lovable thing, the first of which is His good pleasure. So seal me with forgiveness from Thee, O Patron of Beneficence.
Now from Ontario, Canada.
Now back to our story.
What is it in there?
We will be talking about this.
Let me bring in Leo Sazdi. He's a professor of international.
The Spotlight.
The U.S.-China rivalry continues unabated, and as it is customary, the U.S. is flexing its muscles against China. In the latest, the U.S. has said that it is ready to use military power to maintain its international dominance, which it says is being challenged by China. Why does the U.S. feel that it is constantly being threatened by China? Why does the U.S. feel that in order to compete, it has to choose the military option? In this edition of The Spotlight, we will look at why the U.S. is viewed as being a power in decline, how China may be replacing the U.S. in the near future. First, let me introduce our guest for this edition of The Spotlight. Ray McGovern joins us. He's a former CIA analyst who joins us from Raleigh, North Carolina. Also joining us is Glenn Deason, professor of political science at the University of Southeastern Norway, who joins us from Oslo.
This is The Spotlight. The Spotlight takes an in-depth look at the headlines, featuring interviews with well-known guests from diverse backgrounds to get to the bottom of the story. You can listen to The Spotlight every day on IRIB English Radio.
Welcome to you both. So let me first start with you, if I may, Ray McGovern. We're looking at the Defense Secretary Lloyd Austin making these comments about China, of which he has said that, well, China has both the will and the power to reshape the U.S. dominated international order. And then he issues a warning. Washington will not let that happen. And this is while the comments were made when the Pentagon unveiled its latest stealth bomber, the B-21 Raider. What is the U.S. sending as a message there to China?
The message is that no one is going to dominate the world except the United States of America. That's our role. That's what we've been doing since World War II, and even more so since the end of the Cold War. Problem is that reality catches up with us. The problem is that the Chinese are going to surpass us economically, and they're working very hard to surpass us militarily. Not only that, more important still is the fact that China and Russia have the equivalence of a mutual alliance to include help should there be military action on either front. So let me just wind up by saying that at Valdai, at a speech, I think it was the 28th of October, and Mr. Putin said, you know, I don't understand. The U.S. is getting into a proxy war with Russia, and he's getting into trouble with China, too, of his own volition. He says, I don't want to misquote him. He said, you know, frankly, I don't know why the United States is doing this. Are they sane? It seems that this runs completely counter to common sense and logic. This is completely crazy. Now, the Russians and the Chinese don't have to be neurotic to worry about the United States. The U.S. strategic documents say, no, we're going to take Russia out first, and then we're going to work against China. Last thing I'll say is simply that the Chinese, you know, they have about four millennia of experience. They've never wanted to be the superpower of the world. They've got enough problems with their 1.4 billion people whom they've brought out of poverty. So the Chinese attitude, if I read it correctly, is can't we just all get together and live together? Why do we have to have a win-lose situation? How about a win-win situation? Problem is, United States and Joe Biden, in one of his very first speeches, says China is trying to become the dominant superpower. That's not going to happen on my watch. Well, I got news for Joe. It's happening, and it's going to happen even quicker with the Russia-Chinese virtual alliance.
Well, Ray McGovern makes a very good point there, Glenn Deason, about the fact that why does it have to be that route that the U.S. is taking? I mean, you're looking at how, you know, you have this B-21 stealth bomber being unveiled, and obviously the U.S. is sending a military message that it may use military power to maintain its international dominance. Why does the U.S. have to feel like that is the option to take when it comes to China, where China is not looking down that path, although we are saying more and more that it needs to at least show the U.S. the tools that it has?
Well, because after the Cold War, the United States, it put together a security strategy, a security document, very openly saying that its security was dependent on hegemony. So as long as the U.S. was dominant, hegemonic on a global scale, this would be the foundation for security. So any dispersal of power which reduces the dominance of the U.S. will be seen as a threat. Now, again, before you had U.S. and China they were believed to be in this peaceful interdependence. The problem was it was never sustainable. It was supposed to be interdependence between, you know, the dominant and the weaker party. But you saw over time that China was producing and saving while the United States was consuming and borrowing. So as a result, China was accruing more and more industrial power, more and more advanced technology, and this ungodly amount of foreign reserves. Meanwhile, we saw the U.S. was losing a lot of productive power and sinking further into debt. So this was unsustainable in many ways. And at some point, this partnership had to collapse because the U.S. became worried about the growing strength of China, as it feared that China might dethrone the United States, while China became more worried that the United States would then turn to economic and military means to prevent its growth. And this is, at this point, you really needed an agreement where the two big countries could come together and say, listen, the new security system really has to be based on a multipolar format. We can't have this, maintain this unipolar moment of based on U.S. dominance when it's no longer reflected in reality. And again, the United States, it didn't show any interest in this, which is why China began to pursue, technological sovereignty by decoupling from the United States, build its own transportation corridors with this Belt and Road Initiative, develop this financial architecture, new one decoupled from the U.S. with new payment systems and banks and new trading currencies. And the main reason was China was never offered an equal position, as we saw, for example, with the United States blocking Chinese efforts to get, for example, a greater role within the IMF. So because there was no willingness to convert from this unipolar system based on U.S. global hegemony to a multipolar system, it boils down to a military standoff where the United States is now attempting to build up an alliance system, an Asian NATO, if you will, to weaken China. Again, this would come after the United States is able, or if it's able, to break Russia.
Well, you mentioned the Belt and Road, and Ray McGovern, that is one of the shining track records for Xi Jinping that's still in development and is still a work in progress, of which, it's pretty much as it's been called a grand plan for the world economy. And the ones that subscribe to it along this road, the countries obviously are going to reap the benefits from it. At the same time, you've had the U.S. in the context of the Group of Seven leaders in the latest to say that they have raised $600 billion in private and public funds over 5 years to finance what they are calling, the U.S. president has called it, the Partnership for Global Infrastructure and Investment. They made that claim back in June 2022. The year is almost over. I don't think that project is taken off, has it? I didn't see anything on that.
Well, I wish them luck with that. This is all counter to what they see the Chinese succeeding in doing. The Belt and Road Initiative is a major, major deal. And so many countries have become interested in taking part in one way or another. And other countries have sought membership in things like BRICS, the Brazil, Russia, India, China, S is for South Africa, group. And the Shanghai Cooperation Council, they're all turning away from what used to be the hegemon. Now, this is very serious because the sophomores, and again, call them sophomores 2 years running since they flunked last year and had to repeat the year, the sophomores advising Joe Biden don't get it. They don't understand that the day is over when the U.S. calls the shots. And the Ukraine mess is just one example of that, where Russia was trying to protect its own core interests in Europe and enrolled China in supporting them, to the extent, mind you, that China violated its ground core cornerstone principle of non-interference in the affairs of other countries, non-invasion of other countries, the whole Treaty of Westphalia, okay? What did they do? Well, in early February, when Mr. Putin went up to see Xi Jinping, right before the Olympics. Actually, they launched the Olympics on the 4th of February. Putin said to Xi, and this I don't have in any report, but it's the logic that screams out. He said, Xi, the West is not taking us seriously. My people are being killed. The Russian stock people are being killed, up to 13,000 now in the Donbass. There are Nazis running the Ukrainian government. I think I may have to invade. What do you think? Now, my notion, judging from what ensued, is that Xi Jinping said, well, you mean after the Olympics are over, right? Putin smiled and said, oh, yeah. The day after the Olympics were over, Russia recognized the two provinces in the Donbass, Lugansk and Donetsk. 3 days later, the invasion. So it's very, very clear to me when the Chinese sort of condoned that and then offered an exclusion for Russia from the Westphalian principles. And then even, this is important for students of Russia or China, you look at their language and it went away from Westphalia, non-interference in the affairs of other countries, and it said, we Chinese judge core interests pursuing nations on their own merits. So they carved out an exception for China, for Russia. And why? Well, because they're in this thing together. The U.S. has made it absolutely clear that after they, quote, finish off Russia, China is the next in line. So there's a natural alliance here. The fault mostly of the U.S. and its benighted policies toward each country.
All right. Let's look at, since Ray McGovern there, Glenn Deason, has mentioned Russia, let's put that into the context. Let's have you put it into context for us. When the U.S. Talks about how China is going to take on the world order, it's shifting towards China, or that it's actually threatening the world order, which is a U.S. Dominated world order. But now that's changing, and the U.S. says China is the reason for it. But we can't talk about that unless we also bring in Russia into the picture. Isn't that correct? I mean, one example I'm guessing would be, for example, the BRICS group of countries, where you have China and Russia as part of that. And then there's a whole host of things that entail that, from trade to moving away from the dollar to other things that obviously exclude the U.S. Is that what is bothering, or one reason why the U.S. is bothered by this world order that it's losing its grip on?
Yes, but it's often portrayed incorrectly, because it's not a system where U.S. dominance is replaced with Chinese dominance, because the Chinese doesn't actually have any format for unipolarity. I mean, the United States will probably be the world's last unipolar country, because after the United States, the most you can hope for is a bipolar or multipolar system. So, and again, this has been part of the problem. When the West toppled the government in Ukraine and replaced the Russian-friendly government with this anti-Russian government in 2014, this was around the time when the Chinese had started to put out their China industrial policy, the China 2025, the Belt and Road Initiative, and began to develop all these new financial instruments. Now, this was quite dramatic for Russia, because Russia had effectively a very Western-centric foreign policy. It had dreamt about this greater Europe all the way since the days of Gorbachev. But again, when NATO began to expand, they began to lose some faith. But still, many were hoping that they could gradually be integrated with the West and create some common, inclusive European security architecture. But, the toppling of the government in Ukraine really put that killed that off. And what happened since is a tectonic shift. It's Russia embracing now this, what is called the Greater Eurasian Partnership, in which it seeks a closer and integrated economy with countries in the East. So China, Iran, India, Pakistan, South Korea, like all of them in the East. And this is quite interesting, because China, now Russia will obviously not dominate the international economy. It's not powerful in any ways, but it has a good a contribution in terms of supporting China's ambition to create a new parallel international architecture. And you now see this because they're developing, you know, parallel technological hubs and new industries decoupled from the American ones, new transportation corridors, sure. New financial architecture with all their banks and payment systems. And this is quite important in many ways. Of course, even if you look in the area of energy, it's quite extraordinary because Russia is a huge energy exporter. China's the main importer, and now they don't want to trade even in dollars anymore. And you see this spearheading a wider global trend, which you see, for example, even Saudi Arabia perhaps now switching away from dollar for its trade. So these two countries together are kind of spearheading a global trend, which you see with the Shanghai Cooperation Organization and BRICS. Uh-huh. So this is a big problem for Washington if they want to maintain hegemony.
Sure. Well, isn't that part of the world order then? As our guest there mentioned, Ray McGovern, you have Saudi Arabia that announced months ago, of course, at this point, that it is looking at using the yuan in terms of its oil transactions with China. You had actually Israel, a close U.S. ally, that changed a portion of its reserves from dollars to the yuan. And we're seeing these gravitational shifts towards China. And since I mentioned Israel, I do have to mention how a few years back now at this point, but the U.S. issued a harsh warning to Israel and said, don't let the Chinese run Haifa port. And Israel didn't even let the U.S. actually review or look at Haifa port to see the influence that China has there. Also taking a look at the EU. The EU does not want to let go of China in terms of its trading partner, and there's a diversion there. Is that part of the world order that the U.S. is losing its grasp on?
Well, it is. The currency factor is big. There was also a danger that the U.S. dollar would decline in this sense, but now it's sort of on steroids with all these countries, some of which you mentioned, switching into local currency and doing bargaining with Russia. What I'd like to emphasize is the bilateral relationship. Let's take annual trade, for example. Now, my first portfolio at CIA was Sino-Soviet relations. They hated each other. China was claiming large portions of Siberia. They were fighting across the riverine border, and the trade, annual trade, was $100 to $200 million a year. What's it going to be next year? $200 billion. Now, my mathematician son tells me, Dad, that's 1,000 times. 1,000 times means a lot. And, of course, they're natural traders, Russia being very rich in natural resources, and China needing those natural resources. So not only are they under threat from what they perceive as a common enemy, but they're naturally adaptable to satisfying the needs and furthering the trade and the wealth of each country or both countries together.
The fact that the U.S. has a military or militaristic approach towards China is not obviously something that's new there, Glenn Diesel. And I'd like to find out from you, how far do you think the U.S. is going to go when it comes to convincing countries in that part of the world that you know, China is a threat? We know that those countries, many of them are part of these large blocks, trade blocks, that the U.S. is not part of, such as the RCEP, for example. The U.S. is trying to, through the last ASEAN meeting that just occurred, trying to sway these countries into its own sphere. But those ASEAN countries don't want to be in this type of middle ground here. I mean, they want to maintain a middle ground. They don't want to be swayed into U.S. sphere through whatever incentives that the U.S. may be giving it, because, after all, they do lots of trade with China. Do you think the U.S. is going to be successful in doing that?
No, not really. And this is quite a different area than from Europe, because in Europe, we already kind of outsourced a lot of our security to the United States. So for this reason, they do have a huge sway here. But in Asia, you don't see this aspect. You don't see this willingness to join an anti-China bloc. So far, the strongest bloc the United States has been trying to build is the Quad, which is the United States, Japan, Australia, and India. But again, the Indians are not really 100% on board with this. And actually, one of the key consequences of this war in Ukraine is Russia's shifting a lot of its oil exports and gas to the east. So India now is a huge consumer of Russian oil. So for this reason, India is actually being pulled closer into a partnership with Russia. So this makes them less likely to want to join any US-led alliance, as this will not only alienate China, but also Russia. So this idea of developing NATO of Asia, yeah, I don't think it's going to happen. And simply put, it's not, they don't have an option between two opposing alliances, because it's only the United States that are trying to drag them into an alliance. If you look at the Chinese systems they're trying to build, from, you know, the Shanghai Cooperation to BRICS, they're not actually alliances, because alliances are usually country A and B cooperating against country C. But they're not trying to mobilize any countries against the United States. Instead, you see them pulling in actually adversarial countries like, you know, India, Pakistan, now Iran, maybe Saudi Arabia. Like, they want to bring all of this together, because this is a system where you seek security with other members instead of the members seeking security against a non-member. So it's not actually a line system, which is why the Chinese are even a bit reluctant to call the partnership with Russia an alliance, because that indicates it's aimed against someone. Instead, they say it's more than an alliance, because, again, it's not dependent on any aggressive relationship against a third party. So because of this, I don't think that the countries in the region, they don't want to join any side. And because the Chinese aren't pushing them to join an alliance against Americans, all they have to do is sit this one out.
Sure.
And again, if you want to ally against China, that would be a huge risk for the countries in Asia. And as you see, besides from Japan and South Korea, you don't even find any countries in the region who wants to join the sanctions against Russia. So
okay,
if they're not willing to join against Russia, then certainly it's going to be a hard sell to, you know, try to set them up as proxies against the Chinese.
So Ray McGovern, what are we looking at when it comes to the U.S. standing in a matter of speaking? Looking at Latin America, we know that many of those countries are trying to shy away somewhat from the U.S., from what we're seeing in terms of the ones that are being elected. I don't know if you want to call them far right or what you want to call them, but the latest one being Brazil's Lula da Silva, who said, for example, that he wants to have a currency in order to not rely on the dollar or be captive to the dollar. You're looking at Africa, where the U.S. has fallen behind. Well, we've seen what the U.S. has done to Europe in terms of the war in Ukraine and, of course, its allies there, and, of course, then the East. So where hasn't the U.S. already fallen behind then, and therefore they don't have many options out there?
You asked the right question. What has happened is this unipolar position that the U.S. used to occupy, especially since the fall of the Soviet Union, has dissipated. And under the strain of the Ukraine conflict, where the U.S. has not so smartly tried to isolate Russia, not only does the U.S. lose its unipolar position, but it drives the other two main rivals together. Not only is the U.S. not isolating Russia, it's isolating the U.S. and the lily white West. Let me make a point about that. Look at NATO. It's all lily white. Look at China. Look at India. Look at Pakistan or Saudi Arabia or Latin America, what you just meant. They're not so white. They're people of color. So instead of isolating Russia, what we have done is created a new, I call it bipolar, you can call it multipolar if you like, but it's really bipolar in both senses of the word, okay? It's the lily white West against people of color, Russia included, since it's been blackened so much, it's been pretty much, most of them, a lot of them are people of color anyway. That's really dangerous. That puts the world in a schism that if the U.S. doesn't realize that its predominance has ended, that unipolar world is forby, gone, okay, then they're going to act in very rash ways to defend this thing. And that's what scares me, because the people, the sophomores advising Biden, don't know which end is up. They still think that the U.S. is not only, indispensable as well as exceptional, and they can't get it through their heads that that day is over.
Thank you. We're going to end it there. Ray McGovern, we appreciate it. Former CIA analyst there from Raleigh, North Carolina. Glenn Deason, a pleasure. Professor of Political Science at the University of Southeastern Norway from Oslo. With that, we come to an end for this edition of The Spotlight. From Mikhail Vitakway and the team, it's goodbye.
Iranian Radio, Global Mission. This is IRIB English Radio. Log on to our website, www.parstoday.com/en. Under the starry sky of the desert, from the very heart of evergreen forests, with the radiance of silver-colored sand, in the midst of proud mountains, closer, Iran,
hello, I am Mitra. An Iranian nature traveler. To know more about the wonders and beauties of magnificent Iran, keep me company. Of Iranian tea?
Yes, here you are.
Thank you.
Are you going to make a new trip?
Yes, to the city of Maku. I'm going to visit Bahçecuk Palace.
Must be a spectacular sight to visit.
It is.
Thank you.
Baghchaju Palace is a palace located between the border towns of Maku and Bazargan in West Azerbaijan province, northwestern Iran. It is situated in a vast garden covering about 11 hectares. This palace was built at the end of Qajar dynasty under the orders of Iqbalu Sultan Makui, one of the commanders of Muzaffaruddin Shah. Currently, the palace is a museum, also known as Kakh Muzey Maku. The palace consists of two floors that are made up of numerous halls and chambers, most of them beautifully decorated with paintings, mirrorwork, and plaster moldings. Adding to its beauty is the façade, which contains banisters and statues made of plaster. Inside the palace, you will also see gorgeous curtains, colored windows, beautiful super soft beds, as well as impressive chandeliers. Fireplaces are also terrifically adorned in flowers. The iconic landmark in West Azerbaijan province joined Iran's National Heritage List in 1996. Well, I am now in the area of the palace. You know what? I came a long way to get here, but it's worth visiting. It's a big land. I think it could take about 3 hours to visit the whole place. Wow, it's a symmetrical looking building. It's really gorgeous. I wish you were here to see this wonderful palace. Actually, it's a combination of Iranian and Western architecture. Let me get closer to the building. Oh, look! Here is a dusty carriage. It belongs to Iqbalu Sultan Makui, one of the commanders of Muzaffaruddin Shah. And over there is a balcony decorated with plasterwork. Wow, it looks very beautiful. It has a set of staircase and colorful bricks. It said Iqbalu Sultan Makui used to make a speech in this balcony. In an overall look, you can conclude that this building is a very magnificent sight. Those parts with an Iranian architecture are decorated with flower and bush motifs. Thank you. garden? Here is very big. Some sections of the garden are separated with cast iron fences. Very beautiful. And here's full of trees. Berry trees? Walnut trees? Almond trees? Cherry trees, apple and apricot trees. Wow, this garden must look very beautiful in spring. In the western part of the garden, there is an oval-shaped pond. The half-paved garden holds a huge pool which feeds the surrounding plants. It's very intelligent. Though I can't take my eyes off all these beauties, I have to manage my time and take a visit to the palace. First floor. In this floor, we have a dining room known as the Green Chamber. Wow, look at it. It is said one of the most beautiful parts of the palace is a hall called Hovuzkhane. It is also known as the Hall of Mirrors. Ceremonies were held in this hall. Let me take a look inside. Oh, mesmerizing. Beautiful mirror work on the walls. And a fountain in the middle of the hall. Of course, it attracts every soul. There are two sets of staircases on two sides of the building that reach other chambers. I wish I had time to visit those chambers. Stairs, there are stone statues. And let me tell you something interesting. On the second floor of this building, there are dried flowers inside the wall and inside ancient glass containers like the building itself. The door and double glazed windows, the design on the windows, the wooden edge of the windows and arches are other examples of the beauty and magnificence of this building. Iranian architects are unique in the world.
Our voice comes from the heart of beautiful Iran. What you heard was an IRIB English radio program. Our voice comes from the heart of beautiful Iran. IRIB English Radio. This is